You've tuned in to Mythbehaving, a podcast where we get up close and personal with today's most imaginative authors. Every episode, we'll be sitting down with a new writer to discuss their magical worlds, futuristic visions, and how they bring their wildest idea to the page. Sitting in for my missing in action star is my action star, Jen Nixon.
Me.
Jen, how
it's
was your
me.
Thanksgiving?
It was pretty good. How was yours?
It was all right. We had a horrible turkey and I cooked it.
I had chicken.
Oh,
yes.
Nice. Good call.
Yes, definitely.
Very moist.
Yes, very moist.
Excellent, excellent. Because our turkey, we think we had the turkey. We weren't sure, but we actually think the turkey, it was a year in the freezer, which is that's a mistake. So,
well,
that's on us.
You didn't have to pay $98 for it, so that's the plan, right?
You didn't pay $98 for your chicken, did
Nobody
you?
Nobody pays $98 for a chicken.
Well, you brought it up. I didn't know where we were going.
That's true. I did. So who's on the podcast this week?
I am very excited to welcome Jonathan Mayberry. Jonathan is a New York Times bestseller, 5-time Bram Stoker Award winner, anthology editor, comic book writer, executive producer, magazine feature writer, playwright, and writing teacher lecturer. He is the editor of Weird Tales Magazine and president of the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers. He is the recipient of the Ink Pot Award, 3 Scribe Awards, and was named one of today's top 10 horror writers. His books have been sold to more than 30 countries. He writes in several genres, including thriller, horror, science fiction, epic fantasy, and mystery. And he writes for adults, middle grade, and young adult. Ladies and gentlemen, Jonathan Mayberry. Woo!
Woo-hoo! Oh my gosh, I think you're so lazy, you need more jobs.
I was going to say.
I've been trying to cultivate a work ethic, but so far it hasn't been.
You are so lazy. Gosh.
That introduction is bizarre. You know, it's funny, I've been doing this for a while now, and it still always surprises me how much actually gets done in, I guess, 17 years since I've been a fiction writer. There are things like I'll look at a biography and I won't remember something that I've written. It's weird.
That is very, very weird.
Age,
but it's a good thing. It's a good thing to be weird about.
Right. I think that's true. The goal, right?
True. Age might be playing into that too. I'm 65 mark now, and I can feel parts of my brain deciding to shut down and, you know, sell the retail space to Spirit Halloween or something.
No.
Yeah, everything gets a little bit slower. I feel like 25 is the down. Everything goes downhill after 25. So
yeah, when do you hit 65?
No, geez, don't say that.
I'm not that far behind.
I'm at that point where I struggle with certain nouns, like nouns I should probably know, but I just sit there and I'm like, what's that word? The word where the bell does the thing? Oh, ring. That's the. I don't know if you've hit that. Have you hit that yet?
No, my mental GPS burned out, which is interesting. I used to have a great sense of direction. Now I can't. I'm out of directions right now to find the bathroom in my own apartment. So it's an age thing.
Now that's actually funny with the directions, because you used to live on the East Coast, if I remember correctly, and now you are on the West Coast in nice sunny California. What's the difference of getting around in those two areas?
Well, I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia, and it's a nice place to be from. I'm not sure I'm a nice place to live in. Moved out here to San Diego 10 years ago because I visited San Diego, and it's like, oh crap, yes. So I think from the time I got off my wife and I got off the plane to the time we moved to California was like a month.
Oh, geez.
Wow.
It's like, well we really, you know, do not need to live anywhere else. Like this morning, I was sitting in my car at the beach watching dolphins and whales. You know, I can do that every day. It's insane. Really, really not very good ocean views from Philadelphia.
No, definitely not good ocean views.
Yes.
From Philadelphia.
And how has that impacted your writing?
Well, I had a good writing community, you know, back in Philadelphia. I've been community building for writers for about 25 years. And my writing was always pretty steady, but out here in California, two things. One is there was a comic book company here in San Diego, IDW, that I wound up, you know, doing a lot of work with, and they reached out to me like the moment I moved to San Diego. I started writing for them. And, you know, one of the comics I did for them turned into a Netflix show. So, you know, yay. And then, you know, Hollywood is a two hour drive. And a lot of stuff going on up there now. And instead of hopping on a plane to go out for a meeting, now it's, you know, I can just hop in my car. Or, of course, now we have Zoom, which we didn't have 10 years ago. But it's the access to Hollywood and the access to the comic book companies, the, you know, San Diego Comic-Con, all that stuff's really just amped up my involvement with not only the writing community, but different parts of the writing community, opening career doors and opportunities. And like this year at San Diego Comic-Con, you have these impromptu meetings when you're running from panel to panel. And, you know, I got invited to three different comic book projects.
Wow.
Which doesn't happen if you're not there. You can't get by car in traffic.
Absolutely.
And out here, there's a lot of opportunities, a lot of people, you know, deeply involved in the game. So,
I met you 10 years ago at Liberty State's Fiction Writers, and I've been following you ever since, and jealous of you, of course, ever since, because you are so prolific. It's amazing. And it's just, how do you go from one genre to another genre so successfully? Give us some tips there.
There are a couple things about that. One is, there are two people directly responsible for my being able to do that. One was my middle school librarian who introduced me to a whole bunch of professional writers when I was a kid. But every time I would go into the library in my middle school, and I was about the only kid in my school that went into the library voluntarily, I'd go in to get a book, but she would make me take one or two other books that were not in my genre. She said, just read and read and read. And it turned me into the kind of reader who reads all the way across, you know, genre lines, a little of everything. And then one of the people she introduced me to was Richard Matheson.
Mm.
And, Richard, you know, one of the things he told me is that, you know, if you look at his books, almost no two of them would be on the same shelf. You know, I Am Legend, What Dreams May Come, Somewhere in Time, Shrinking Man, you know, he's all over the place. And he said he just writes the book that he most loves and then goes, you know, figures out how to sell it or gives it to his agent to try to sell it. That way he's always writing to his passion rather than writing to the market. And those two things really imprinted on me. And, you know, I read, like I said, everything, you know, absolutely everything. And when you read something and you're a writer, it's kind of hard not to want to contribute to that body of literature to write in that space.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that also opened, you know, one of the business advantages is I can write, like I write 3 to 4 novels a year, but they're in different genres and sometimes for different publishers, but they don't compete with each other.
Mm.
Right.
If I wrote, say, 3 thrillers a year, for different publishers, I'd be competing against myself. Mm-hmm. My publishers would not like that. But, you know, this year I had a weird science thriller out. I had a deep space science fiction series launch. I had an epic fantasy novel, you know, so each is different. And there's no chance of ever being bored when you can jump around from genre to genre.
Mm-hmm.
And you're constantly expanding your writer's tool set by trying new things, new forms. And it gives you a reason to start reading deeply into another genre as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And do you bounce from manuscript to manuscript or do you stay one book at a time?
My writing process is kind of strange. I do one novel at a time, but while I'm doing that novel, I'm doing research for the next novel.
Mm.
But like, for example, right now I'm writing my 14th Joe Ledger novel, which is a, you know, weird science thriller, but my next book I'll be writing is a cosmic deep space cosmic horror. So I'm doing, you know, a lot of research on astronomy and so on that will play into that book. So one novel at a time, but since I know how long it takes me to write a novel, about 3 months on average, I have to budget into that time, into those 3 months, time to write short stories, edit anthologies, edit Weird Tales magazine, and do other things. So it's really an ongoing process of refining time management.
Yeah.
And also, you know, being disciplined. And I was, you know, I went to journalism school, not creative writing school, and they are very much about discipline. If you're a newspaper reporter, you can't say, I've got to wait for the muse to hit me.
Mm-hmm.
You have to care, write it quick and dirty, revise it, and move on. And that I took that ethic to fiction, and it works really, really, really well.
That's I know a lot of writers are like, no, I want to stay in my comfort zone and not risk stepping out of there. What's the biggest risk you would say you would take?
You mean a risk that I haven't, something I haven't done yet?
Right. Like, or what well, is the biggest risk you took? Was it like going from journalism?
Yeah, trying fiction actually, because I was never interested in fiction my whole life. I mean, I was a magazine feature writer and nonfiction book writer, mm-hmm. and I started out writing articles for Black Belt magazine, and you know, a lot of that sort of stuff, and travel and skydiving and all sorts of things. My first nonfiction book was a judo textbook for Temple University when I was teaching at Temple, and I didn't really get interested in fiction until I was doing a nonfiction book on folklore in the early 2000s. And I kept looking for novels to read where the versions of the monsters that people encountered were the folkloric versions, not the Hollywood versions, because right. the vampires and werewolves and so on in folklore are totally different than what you see in the movies. I mean, mm-hmm. there's almost no comparison. So as a result of not being able to find much, my wife said, well, just stop bitching about it, write the damn thing. And I had to teach myself how to write fiction because I had never studied creative writing. And I wrote a novel. I wound up liking the process of writing it, even though it took, you know, 3.5 years to do. And I liked how it came out. I got an agent quickly. She sold it quickly, and it won a Stoker Award. Mm. As a validation for trying something new, you know, that kind of goes a long way.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a fuel on the fire.
It really is.
It's like in a grand slam, your first freaking baseball game.
It was kind of weird. I mean, I never expected that. I never expected to actually get any fiction published. Mm. I just didn't ever think of myself as a fictioneer, you know. And that book came out in 2006, and I am now writing my 50th novel.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I fell in love with the fiction hard.
Yeah. Do you still write nonfiction?
I'll do the occasional article. Most of the recent nonfiction I'm doing is actually forewords and introductions to books. Like, for example, Kevin J. Anderson's Wordfire Press sometimes republishes classic works like Jules Verne's An Arctic Mystery and the narrative of Arthur Gooden Pym of Nantucket by Edgar Allan Poe, etc. Since I love a lot of, you know, classic fiction, especially the weird stuff, I get asked a lot to write forwards. I just finished one the other day. It was a forward to House by the on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson, a novel that I fell in love with when I think I was 13. And so, you know, it's like an article. It's about a 2000 word introduction. So it's kind of like an article. And I've been doing a bunch of those recently. I've done 4 for Wordfire. First one was Alexander Dumas, the guy who did Three Musketeers, wrote a werewolf novel. And, called the Wolf.
No. Yeah. What? No, I thought I knew all his. No, okay. No. What's the title of that?
The Wolf Leader.
Really?
My grandmother gave that one to me when I was a kid. So I, that's the kind of the nonfiction I'm doing now. And I'm trying to talk my agent into letting me write a nonfiction book on writing fight and action scenes. And she's fighting me every step of the way.
Oh, my God. No. That's... Why?
It's purely mercenary thing, because you know what she could get for a nonfiction writing book as opposed to what she could get for a novel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a 10-to-1 difference,
right?
And you know, I would have to justify it to her and to my wife and to my accountant. And
but do you know how many hours writers spend on that kind of stuff?
Yeah, amazing. Well, I teach workshops on it. On that subject, I don't know. I just haven't gotten the urge to go back and do many nonfiction books at this point. I did 20 some, I think, over the years. The last.
Why don't you disguise it as a fiction book, but just make it instructional-ish?
An argument can be made that my Joe Ledger thriller series is an instructional manual on how to fight. The way he fights is based on the way I fight. I've been doing martial arts for 59 years. I was a bodyguard for years and so on. And when I write a fight scene, the fight scene is accurate.
Nice. I've read some of your Joe Ledgers, and that is one of my takeaways, is that you see the fight and it feels correct to me. I've done a little martial arts, enough to not hit myself in the face. And that's enough that I'm like, yeah, I think he knows what he's talking about here. Yeah.
It's funny. I one of my early jobs was expert witness for the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office for murder cases involved martial arts, and so some of that was fascinating, and some of the forensic thought process filters into my writing as well.
Can you share like your craziest expert trial moment?
Well, yeah, I had this one guy. It was a murder trial. He and his girlfriend were arguing, and she was apparently yelling at him. So he got her in what he said was a chokehold, a judo chokehold to quiet her down so that she wouldn't get hysterical. Typical male rationalization.
Wow.
And he killed her. And when I was looking at the autopsy photos and reading the autopsy report, actually before I even read the report, the coroner asked me, how could somebody die from a judo chokehold if judo is a sport? And I said, well, a judo chokehold would be a valve thing. It would cut off, both air and blood to the brain. But most likely what he did was a bar choke, which is a jiu-jitsu technique. And he probably crushed her hyoid bone. And then he showed me the report. In fact, it was the crushed hyoid bone. Mm-hmm. If he had practiced judo, he would know the difference.
Oh, yep. Whoops.
He got convicted.
Yeah.
And then while I was on the stand, he's sitting there glaring at me, trying to give me the death stare. And it's like, dude, first off, I'm five times your size. Second, no.
You're going to jail.
You're going to go to jail for a very long time.
Twice now. Yeah, let's do it twice. This episode of Myth Behaving is brought to you by the Bath Bomb Diva, producing fine handcrafted bath bombs and shower steamers. Scents ranging from fruits to florals to musks and more. An observation of Mariah Carey's annual teeth-gnashing, mouth-foaming rampage through modern civilization, the Diva offers up new holiday goodness with fizzy, fragrant bath salts and bubble bath bomb hot tubs. These great stocking stuffers made with wonderful scents such as warm vanilla sugar, sugar cookie, and comfort and joy. What does comfort and joy smell like? Beats me. But they all include small toy surprises like bendable figures, flashing LED light cubes, and cool toy erasers that are sure to delight. 4 out of 5 people randomly surveyed at my house show that even the most stubborn anti-bather will absolutely look forward to jumping into a tub made wondrous and magical by the Bath Bomb Diva. Thanks, as always, to Bath Bomb Diva for being a valued sponsor to the show.
So you have something a little bit different than some of our other guests. You have had a show on Netflix. I loved it, and I was so upset when it got canceled. So tell us a little
name
bit
it
about
first.
That
let's, oh, well, the, no, the show
I
is called
V-Wars.
Yeah, V-Wars. V is in vampire.
Yes.
The science fiction take on vampires based on a series of shared world anthologies that I did, where I did a 50,000-word short novel and then had other writers come in and write field reports as this plague was going around that was turning people into vampires. We also did comics too. But it launched at the beginning of COVID. And even though we were the number one show in 120 world markets, global markets, Netflix freaked out because they said they didn't want to do a plague show during a plague.
Oh my God.
Which,
is that really what they said?
That's what they said. And our star, Ian Somerhalder, who starred in Vampire Diaries, he and I, we were like, you just got to be kidding us. You know, that sounds like a joke. 120 world markets, we were number one. So the rights have now reverted to me. And Ian and I and a producer friend of ours and a showrunner we're talking to are cooking up a new, much grittier version of it that we're going to shop to another network. Place about maybe 8 or 10 years after the first season that was on Netflix.
Oh, nice.
I would love that.
And it's the version we're cooking up is really going to be edgy because the show was good, but the books dug deeper into issues of racism and intolerance, which was the subtext of the entire series.
Mm-hmm.
And the show, written by a couple of well-meaning Canadians, was a good show, but it was a little more polite than we wanted that discussion on racism.
Canadians, what are you going to do? No, it was really good. It was a lot of fun to watch. And uh, I, You had some really great stars on there. How much involvement did you have directly? Because you talked about, you know, working directly with Mr. Somerhalder.
So the way that worked is I was, excuse me, when it first launched, or first started shooting, you know, I was up at the table reads, and I was, my wife and son and I were on the set. It was all great, but I was not yet an executive producer. And so I was not involved in the writing of the show. It wasn't until the near the end, when by that point Ian and I had become really close friends, and he said that he wanted me to be executive producer. So they made me executive producer a week before the show aired. The only creative part of the show that I got to do was to name the episodes. Now, because of that, now any project I do that is in development or production, I'm an executive producer on. In fact, I have a film in development with Alcon Entertainment. They did The Expanse. They did World of Eli, Blade Runner 2049, Book of Eli, rather.
Book of Eli.
And so they're doing my Rot and Ruin post-apocalyptic zombie teen series. And I'm executive producer on that. In fact, one of the first things I got to do as executive producer is to read the script and give notes.
Oh,
that was fun. You know,
that also, is fun.
It's a good script too. So there, that was on hold of obviously during the strike, but now the strike is over. They're back to work on the script.
Is that a little surreal to like see somebody take what you've done and then reimagine it, and then you get to read what they've reimagined?
Yeah, I mean, I've never done acid, but I'm pretty sure this is what it's like. It's wildly surreal. There's a part of me that's standing, you know, apart watching me going, he's sitting there reading the script to his movie. Isn't that interesting? You know, and it's crazy. And it's funny because that whole V-Wars project came about indirectly because of Max Brooks. You know who Max Brooks?
Yeah, World War Z. Yeah,
yeah. So he had edited an anthology for IDW, a G.I. Joe anthology, for which I'd written a novella, and he was supposed to do another project, but it didn't happen. And the editors at IDW said, "Hey, would you like to do an anthology?" And I had just been cooking up an idea for what was going to be a Joe Ledger novel about this vampire plague. And I said, nah, I think I'd like to do that as a shared world anthology. And boom. You know, it's funny how that stuff happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right place, right time.
And the willingness.
Never saying no.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's been a big factor of my career. Like, I've been asked to do some pretty bizarre stuff that is not in my CV of things that I'm supposed to be good at. And you get the reputation of being the kind of person that will try anything. Like, I got a call one day while I was still living in Pennsylvania from Axel Alonso, who was the editor-in-chief of Marvel at the time. He had read the first Joe Ledger novel and called me up and asked me if I might possibly be interested in writing for comics. Which
yes. Whatever,
is the dumbest question anyone's ever asked me.
Right, right.
No, let me think about it. You know, so I said yes. You know, I said, you know, providing we can work out a deal, and I turfed him over to my agent. But while I'm, you know, I had no idea what a comic book script even looked like. But I said yes. So for a writer, writers are knowledge junkies. It's an opportunity for me to learn a new form of writing. And, you know, not only did I get to write for Marvel and do a lot of stuff, the most recent Marvel the second movie in the Black Panther series, Wakanda Forever, is based, about 40% of that's based on my comics.
Oh, you know, and, so yeah, awesome.
I was the first one to put Shuri in the uniform as the Panther. I put her up against Namor. I created the Midnight Angels and created the character Nika.
Nice.
Back in 2009 and 10. And again, would not have happened had Richard Matheson not encouraged me to step outside my comfort zone.
Goes all the way back to I Am Legend. Yeah, that's awesome. It does. What is the difference between writing a novel and writing a comic book?
Well, according to the letterers, who are the unspoken heroes of the comics, for example, when I turned in one of my scripts and he was looking at it and looking at the art, he sent me a very polite note saying, I love all the dialogue you have, but at some point, would you like people to see the actual art?
Right. Whoops.
Yeah. Because, you know, I write like novels that are 140, 180,000 words, a lot of dialogue, a lot of stuff. Comics, right. 20 pages, 22 pages, and it's all driven by the art. Mm-hmm. So the learning curve is, first off, it's a team effort because the editor is extremely hands-on, the artist is hands-on, the letterer is hands-on, and the colorist is hands-on. Mm-hmm. And each is playing their A game to create something that is primarily a visual medium. And you have to dial back your ego and dial back how much you need to say or have characters say in favor of how much the art can show. So there's that part, you know, the writer is actually the one that comes up with the number of panels on the page and the art direction for what goes in each panel. Mm-hmm. So I have to create the visuals in my head and convey that to the artist. So the artist can then tell story with graphics. And then I have to listen to the artist to make sure that I'm not crowding out his vision. Mm-hmm. And it's a fun process. I've been told that writing an episode, one issue of a comic is similar to writing an episode of television, mm-hmm. Which is about right. So it's kind of closer, if it's closer to, in terms of prose, to short stories than it is to novels.
Mm. Right. And it's almost like the opposite. You want to tell instead of, because the artists are doing the show part, you're kind of just doing the tell part.
and before you really grasp, you know, how it all works, there is a fear that your words, your story gets lost in the art because it's not the way you normally tell a story. Mm-hmm. But then you realize that it, you know, the comic exists because you've created the story and worked with the artist and everyone and the whole team to get it right. So it's not about you, it's about us. Mm-hmm. And that's tough for a lot of writers to really get the it's about us thing.
That's awesome. I would probably like that because I can't visualize anything in my head. So if someone else can, and then I can just put like, you know, the emotion into it and a little bit of the dialogue and someone else is doing all the background that I think I see in my head, but I don't, that would be awesome.
Yeah. And it's amazing what the different professionals within the team bring to it. You know, Lee Loffrich, who I've worked with on a couple of Punisher projects, he does these single color cinematic tone washes for on these panels that can elevate just single moment, a single panel can elevate the story into something more with a little more gravity and sobriety to it. It's something that I can't even conceive when writing it, but seeing what he does with it and the artists do with it, just that's its own kind of magic, really.
Do you have a preference? Do you have a preference of writing book? I know you're like, you're a novelist, so that's...
I'm a novelist by heart, yeah.
But like, if somebody was like, choose one.
Novels, for sure. Right. Yeah, I'm writing my 50th. I've got six more sold that I haven't written yet. And my agent wants the pitches for the next bunch. Mm-hmm. So I'm a novelist. I love short stories. I've written 152 of them, writing my 153rd right now. Under non-disclosure agreement because it's tied to a video game.
Oh.
I know.
Spoilers, like, spoilers.
That was brutal, right?
I did one earlier this year that, you know, came out and, you know, it's available for free online, a Diablo 4 short story. Oh, nice. But I'm doing one for a different video game, much bigger video game. And it's fun because I started writing it today and it's a lot of fun to do.
Bigger than Diablo 4. Okay. Bigger than that's the teaser. Bigger than Diablo 4 because Diablo 4 was pretty big. Yeah. It was game of the year for a lot of people. So
it's a fantastic game too.
Yeah.
I'm a novelist by heart. I love comics. I love short stories. I think short stories and comics kind of run neck and neck for me. Mm-hmm. I've had some of my biggest career moments writing short stories. Actually, I wrote a short Wizard of Oz story that is now been added to the official chronology of Oz by the estate of L. Frank Baum.
Oh, wow. Which,
yeah.
That's amazing.
It freaks me out a little bit.
A little. Yeah. I can see that.
But I love comics. Like right now I'm doing one. I just sent the pitch in waiting for the approval, but it's Godzilla versus Cthulhu. Mm. How could I not want to do that?
Oh,
my gosh.
My
You're just a fountain of teasing.
Yeah. You just said Godzilla.
He just dropped. And Cthulhu, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I'm a Godzilla fan, sorry.
Yeah, me too. I
Godzilla's like my shit.
Literally have a Godzilla on my shelf to my right, and I have a Cthulhu Santa Claus on my table back there.
You can't see it,
I'm
Jonathan,
a girl
but I'm trying
who
to
likes
push
Godzilla. It took me 50 years to find another girl who liked Godzilla. Nobody liked Godzilla when I was a kid.
Yeah, Godzilla. Godzilla's the guy, big G. And I also Crystal Lake is going to be starting a Kickstarter in January, I think it is, for a Joe Ledger horror comic.
Oh.
So that's really a lot of fun.
All right. I'm trying to push money through my screen at you right now. Take my money, right, faster.
You have to take all my money.
Yep.
So I have one last question before we wrap up the podcast. Since you've gone out of your comfort zone, tell us one genre that you haven't yet written in that you would like to.
I have solid ideas, good stories that I haven't yet convinced my agent to pitch. A romance novel, a literary novel, and a straight Western. I want to write one of each.
Oh.
And my agent is like, yeah, you could, but you don't make as much money. And unfortunately, when you become a full-time writer, you have to really think about bottom line. You got a family to provide for and
right
stuff. But they would be fun to do.
Does your public or your agent really honestly think that you won't sell anything because of the genre? I mean, that don't
no, it's not that I won't
some
sell.
Of your audience come with you to every book you write?
Yeah, she knows she could sell them, but she couldn't sell them for as much up front because I have no footprint at all in those genres.
Right. I see.
And there are some genres that are new to you can take, like when I did my epic fantasy. Even though I've never written epic fantasy before, that didn't seem as much of a stretch to my agent or my publisher. Mm-hmm. So that deal, you know, when a publisher asked me if I wanted to write epic fantasy, she was able to make the deal in under 4 hours.
So maybe you have to like throw some sci-fi into the romance.
Well, there's technically romance in all my science fiction, all my fantasy.
Right.
I'm doing a series. The first book in the series came out that I co-wrote with Weston Oakes, who sadly passed 2 weeks ago. Mm. One of my best friends in the world. And,
sorry,
yeah, The Sleeper's War Alpha Wave is his last published book. And that has a strong romance in it. So, you know, it's not like I can't do romance. It's just
half the literary books I see are sci-fi. So The Lovely Bones was considered literally that's sci-fi. I'm sorry. The other one, the Japanese one, that was sci-fi. literary.
No, but there's, you know, the Sleeper's War is definitely sci-fi. It's aliens, you know, us fighting them. And then I've got a cosmic horror. There's a brand new imprint of Weird Tale of Blackstone Publishing called Weird Tales Presents. And I'll be launching that imprint with my novel Necrotech, which is deep space cosmic horror. And that was enormous fun to write.
Mm.
Real briefly, the conceit was while trying to figure out how to do teleportation, we accidentally teleport the entire space station lab across the galaxy instead of the test capsule. Mm-hmm. So now 56,000 light years away, they're never getting home. And they found out the creatures like Cthulhu and so on that came to Earth, came to Earth because they were afraid of what's out there.
Oh, uh-oh. Whoops.
Great.
That's a whoops-a-daisy.
If you can imagine Pacific Rim up against outer gods, you're pretty much in that zone.
And no resources from home. So that's...
But alien spaceships that turn into giant robots piloted.
Oh, that's great.
You're just the worst. My pocketbook keeps emptying every time you talk. Oh, my goodness, Jonathan, you have been a wonderful guest. We knew you would be.
Absolutely.
We were so thrilled to have you on.
Oh, it's
Jen,
fun.
What do you got? You got anything last?
Oh, well, Jen, you got anything?
Oh, no, I got the last question. I'm good. I want to hear what's coming up next for you.
Yeah, go ahead, Jonathan. Give us your last.
It's been a big year for book releases and a big fall for book releases. Alpha Wave or The Sleeper's War Alpha Wave just came out. A new Joe Ledger short story, an anthology came out with stories by Scott Sigler, Peter Kleins, Kevin Anderson, Wayne Brady.
Oh wow.
My gosh.
That actual Wayne Brady, who's a Joe Ledger fan.
Wayne Brady, yeah.
And we just published the Weird Tales 100th Anniversary Anthology, and from Blackstone, 100 Years of Weird. It's the anthology I am most proud of, and it is the absolutely beautiful interior design and layout, and I'm just so freaking happy with this thing.
And that's available now?
Yeah, it's available now in hardcover and audiobook, and it has not only classic stories by like Robert Bloch and Ray Bradbury and so on, and Tennessee Williams, who actually wrote for Weird Tales, but it also has new stuff by a range of writers. To give you an idea of the range of writers, R.L. Stine and Laura Lee Hamilton.
Oh, nice.
Oh, my gosh. That is a range.
They're ends of the universe. In terms of the but they both wrote Weird Tales stories for me.
That's great.
All that stuff is out, and I got a bunch of work coming up next year.
Oh, we have super enjoyed having you. We would love to have you back again, Jonathan.
Anytime.
I'm just floored. When Jen hit me up, I was like, really? Because you're on. So we will absolutely have you back again if you will have us. That would be wonderful.
I would love to. This has been I can't believe this was that fast. It was over in a heartbeat. It was great.
I know, right? It just goes by fast. I'd do it for 2 hours if I could, but I don't think Rob's wife would let us do that.
Right. And our listeners would be like, why is this still going? He's great, but why is it still going?
So, and also, you guys have a great conversational style and good questions. So it makes it easy to be a happy guest.
That's what we like to hear. That we're doing a good job too. So, all right, Jen, we did it. We did it again.
We did. Guess what? Next week's December.
We're there. We've made it again. We've made it almost to winter. So that is great.
Yep.
All
there.
Right. So we will close out here. Jonathan, it has been great.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for talking with us.
You and I will talk again.
Have a great week, everyone.
Bye.